Hey guys, it's The Great Debate.
Nice.
Guess what? We've got a special guest in studio sitting in Dave King's chair. Dan Graney's here. Dan's
what?
Was a writer for The Simpsons for a long time and continues to be. He's writing scripts. He's into community development. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to occupy a chair once occupied by Dave King and
Dave,
soon to be off.
Dave, wait, where is Dave?
We're missing Dave. Okay.
I can
and
feel
I don't just
there
mean
seems to be a sorrow.
I
here.
Don't just mean he's not here. I mean we're missing him. He's deep in the weeds doing production on his TV show called
As
Love.
As in like we don't know where he is?
No. He's working hard on his TV show Love on Netflix.
Right.
Season 3 is coming. He's helping to produce it, so he's a busy man. He had to miss tonight's record. We got Dan to fill in. We're really happy to have him.
We're psyched to have him.
Now Dan, this is kind of like the third rail. Dan is an electrifying debate. Let's just, you know what, why am I talking?
Why don't we just get right into it?
I want to bring down expectations. I'm here to avoid committing career suicide. That's my goal tonight. So I cannot promise entertainment. All I can do is try not to show you who I really
the
am.
The first step to that is a micro.
I've got 4 minutes on the clock. We're going to try something out that's new. We usually do 3 minutes on a micro clock. I've been feeling lately like not enough happens in that amount of time.
A strong micro.
So, Dan, you're going to get a chance at a more generous opening statement here. And I'm going to have you take the pro on this micro debate topic. 4 minutes on the clock. Dan Graney taking the pro. Topic is people who are emotionally invested in books or music after the age of 40 are lying.
Well, I am only one man, and I only have my own experience to consult, but I can speak of it truthfully, and I think other people do not speak of their experience truthfully, and I do not give a shit about anything anymore. And I don't care about music, I don't care about movies, I don't care about books, I don't care about poems, and I think it all just died at around age 35 or 36. And I think everybody that is reading books and going to plays are just afraid to admit that they don't care.
Okay, I'm Steve Healy. I'm taking the con, unusually for me. Let me throw something at you, Dan, because you're not a family man. You are a family man, but you don't have children, right? And wouldn't
That's
it be
true.
Possible to really extra connect emotionally with books and music over age 40 when you have kids and you're sharing them with your kids? For example, getting way back into Lord of the Rings that you enjoyed as a boy and now you're reading it to your children, or like seeing your kids get into Star Wars and you're reconnecting with it, or like your son is listening to some Bob Dylan and you're into that. I mean, me and my dad used to listen to the Grateful Dead together, and I would say he was into it in a like second reawakening of some musical interests of his youth.
Well, Steve, you're right. However, that's not a point I had considered, and I do think that the experience of being a parent might have caused some process of rejuvenation in my own emotional sustenance that would have enabled me to have those experiences.
Right.
But it didn't. So maybe I have fast-forwarded to 80 or something like this, and I'm just experiencing a terminal state.
Well, wait. I'm not going to let you get away with this. So, if we have to switch sides, I will.
I thought you made a good point.
No, let me turn around and defeat my own point then, because they don't care. They're just happy their kids have something to while away the hours. But,
well, going somewhere with it, okay. Which is that the experience which these people are having vicariously through their children is no longer an experience of media. It's an experience of nurturance for that young person and identification with that person. And this more homely feeling of, you know, like petting your cat or nurturing your child, well, that lingers on. That's a basic human feeling that is not involved in the process of symbolic cogitation that goes on when we consume media. And I would say that the mental and emotional and spiritual faculties which we engage when we consume media, they're dead. But the more fundamental qualities of heart which are involved in nurturing the young are still there. And they can perhaps stir the dust and the memories of our own earlier aspirational time.
Okay, well, let's leave children out of it, and I'll try and win it fair and square on just like those qualities are not dead. They may be diminished. The light may slowly be going out on caring about books and movies and music, but like that only makes it more important to blow on the embers and keep the fire going. Like, if anything, I think people over 40 might double down on their passion for, you know, the Beach Boys or whatever they're into. Bruce
Springsteen. This makes me much happier that now that I know you're wrong. your first point was confusing because you were right. But here, you're dead wrong, because the process of maturity, which seems to have been forgotten about as something that actually happens with human beings, goes from emulation to manifestation, where as a young person, you go to the ball game and you look at the ball players and you want to be them. Later on, you are the ball player. And I think in the larger sense, culturally, you no longer need to be the consumer of media who has a vicarious experience of emotional states or experiences. You have your own depth of being to consult.
Oh, there's the timer. I think we got some real. Medeans, what do you think?
I'm going with Dan.
Whoa! Even after you took the first round.
I mean, I'm sort of at a loss because I'm shocked at in a way, the pro argument here was the con side, the negative side, right?
Yeah.
The less life affirming side.
Yeah.
And I'm shocked to hear it so well fleshed out.
It was beautifully fleshed out. I got to give it up.
Dave, I love you, but
I would have liked to have heard more about the lying aspect. You know, that why are people lying about it?
I agree with that a little bit.
Yeah, next time.
I was at a Bruce Springsteen show where
I think people hesitate to be honest. I think this very same quality that leads them to still read books leads them to lie about getting anything out of them, because they are not secure enough to just consult their own
experience. You've had 40 years of adventure and whatever.
Right.
And what you didn't have, you're never going to have.
Samuel Eliot Morrison said, the great naval
we
historian,
him.
He said, "Dream dreams, and write them, but live them first."
Wow. Now, he's a guy who actually had a lot of life experience after, wasn't he like 50 or 60 when World War II broke out? And he was like the official naval historian. He was was living up to the fantasy he'd had as a youth.
But I think he'd had some experiences before, and I don't know what they are because I didn't read any of his books. I only read his inscription on a statue.
That's pretty cool. So we should have some host chat, right?
I would love that.
Dan Graney's here. He's written many episodes of The Simpsons. How many episodes would you say?
I have written 17 or 18. Wow. We just were going down the numbers the other day. It's pretty pathetic. There's about 10 people above me.
Still, not bad.
I think they're good.
And you contributed to many more, as people know.
I contributed to many more.
But you've also had you had a whole other life. You were a reporter for USA Today. Or involved with USA Today.
I was a gopher for the chairman of the board of the Gannett Company, who was the founder of USA Today.
Gotcha.
Was the most powerful, dynamic, original, creative person in American media before the internet happened.
Right.
He was this person, we now don't think about him anymore, but in the 80s, Al Newhart was the innovator. And things that you see on the internet now are kind of like he did in newspapers before, in infographics, data-driven stuff, bullet points. USA Today kind of anticipated the internet. He was a visionary, but he's also a nutball and a bit of a tyrant, and I was his lackey.
Okay, and you're also a trained lawyer. You went to Harvard Law School.
I went to Harvard Law School. I worked for 2 years in an excellent law firm full of superb lawyers who quickly realized I was not good enough.
I like there's a story that you told me one time about your experience at law school that I'd like to share with the listeners, because it struck me as very funny. You had a roommate, and the roommate or something, a guy went to a meeting, and he came back from the meeting and he said, "I've just
met." Let me fill in a little bit before you.
Please.
This was probably in my first year at law school, 1989-90, that year. The person coming back was an extremely good law student who had just made the Harvard Law Review.
Gotcha.
So he was one of the top people in our class. He's a brilliant guy. And I had not managed to make that accomplishment. And I ran into him after he came back from first organizational meeting of the Harvard Law Review.
Gotcha. And he said to you, "I just met the first black president of the United States."
Yes.
And he was talking about Barack Obama.
Yes.
Wow.
And that was January 1990. Something like that.
You told me that story, and then months or maybe even years later, you added that this guy had a couple other times said he met the first whatever president. Like he identified several other
who
future
else
presidents
on his list.
That I don't recall.
Okay. Should we give this info to the Democratic
National Committee?
This is
real.
Committee?
If he did that,
because I thought I was like, wow, what an amazing story. This guy so smart to identify that, and you were like, yeah, well, he said it about four or five other people. Too.
No. Okay. That was just a joke. The same person, I once asked him like how he got to, he was first in our class at law school at one point. Wow. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, I work like a fucking animal. Wow. And he was a really smart guy and he worked really hard.
Do animals work at all?
Do they work? I mean, they hunt and they fish and they
subjugate them. So he must have worked. Yeah. He worked like an animal subjugated by the person being himself.
Right.
Nobody works harder than a person, I think. No animal.
Oh, sure.
An ant or a bee?
No, subjugated animals. You know, cows.
A horse.
Yeah, but you got oxen, whip pull, it and so oxen
yeah,
that pull.
Oxen.
Interesting.
Plows.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can we go back to USA Today for a minute? What was a typical kind of like lackey task for...
Can I give you the typical or can I give you the best?
Well, the best. Clearly the best.
Okay. So I went on a 50-state tour with Alan H. Newhart and a bunch of other people. It was called Buscapade USA. Now, Al had flair and he named things goofy things like that because it was fun. We went on a bus to all 50 states. Al just flew in and out. He wasn't going to ride the stupid bus. We got to the end of the tour. We got to his home state, Florida, which was the end of the tour. We went to the Cocoa Beach newspaper, which was a newspaper which he owned 100 newspapers. The company owned 100 newspapers. He had a statue of himself outside the Florida Today, Cocoa Beach. And the end of this tour, that I had gone to Harvard was not lost on him. It was one of the satisfactions of having me as his lackey. And this is a story I hesitate to tell, but whatever. After we had completed 6 months on this tour, after 50 states, we were leaving this, and he said, Dan, I think the plaque on my statue looked a little dusty. And I said, well, that's too bad. He said, no, I think you should go dust it. And I said, come on, you're kidding. He said, no, I think you should go dust the plaque off. The dust off my plaque.
Dust off my statue.
Yes. And so,
wow.
God help me, I did.
You did it. Yeah.
I did. I went and polished off the dust off his thing. And I feel like that fundamental lack of character explains a lot.
Hey, I could you could see that story another way as being like, you know, I dusted that damn statue best as it had ever been dusted.
No, I was very ashamed. I kind of half-heartedly, I didn't commit to it. I was mortified, but I did it.
Well, here's your chance to redeem yourself through the art and sport of debate.
I've got another debate for us to get into. Good. And in this one, I'm going to have Healy take the pro.
Okay.
More traditional role.
Yes.
And the topic up for debate, if we're ready.
Yes.
It would be kind of fun to be Trump's attorney.
I'm Steve Healy. I'm taking the pro. As of the time of the record, Trump is involved in many self-created and other created legal complications, we might say. I imagine those will continue or perhaps reach some resolution just in the time in between we record this and it goes on air. A lot of this debate is going to come down to the word kinda. Because I don't think it would be fun all the time to work for Donald Trump, a famous jerk who is, his catchphrase is you're fired. That sounds a bit stressful. But let's say you're an attorney. What could be more challenging and more engaging than unraveling the Byzantine legal morass that this guy's got himself into? Working out the strange, I mean, you're getting down to like the words of the Constitution. What is a foreign emolument? How do we even say the word? What constitutes that?
Real fine legal point.
When is the president like doing something illegal? If he tweets something, is that a public record that he can be sued about? If he makes a spurious claim as president about a former president, as he apparently did about Obama, what are the legal ramifications of that? I think you can see in the Kellyanne Conways and the people that go out on the Sunday shows for Trump, his advocates, a kind of wicked joy in trying to advocate for this maniac who just changes the rules of the game constantly, and to try and play the game with him and make him seem normal is a kind of twisted, but I think kind of interesting fun that a good lawyer would enjoy.
Damn. Well, first off, I'd like to thank you, Steve, for having me on your show. I'd like to thank the entire team here for the honor of being with you. I'd like to thank you, Steve, in a wider sense, for creating this show and for the role that you play in Los Angeles literary and intellectual community, and the way that you embellish it with your presence, your learnedness, your scholarship. I'd like to further thank you, Steve, as an exemplar of scholarship carried lightly, of grace under pressure, of courage, of tenacity, of adventure when you go on these things. I thank you for modeling a litany of virtues that could be inscribed around the Parthenon. Okay. And I feel that it is almost pitiful, mean-spirited of me to say this person, this monument to virtue, should also be right about this trivial question of whether it will be fun. So I apologize for caring that you are wrong about this. And I would say that your error consists largely, I'm thinking, that as a non-lawyer, you don't understand that a lawyer values the things on this very specific properties, which is, what would it be like for me to be Donald Trump's lawyer? You're talking about some fantasy lawyer. I'm talking about the concrete reality of me.
Right.
And that reality was of an incompetent, unprepared, confused, terrified lawyer.
Right.
So I would be there like Sean Spicer or like somebody else, not knowing what the hell we're doing, not knowing what the law is, pretty sure I'm getting in deeper and deeper trouble every time I open my mouth, afraid I'm going to be the one that gets hung out to dry, sure that much smarter lawyers than me are looking over the whole thing right now, seeing every mistake I'm making. So it might be fun for your fantasy lawyer to be, you know, diabolically, you know, finding Donald Trump's way out of this mess. But for me, I would be digging him in deeper and burying myself with him. And I do not think that would be fun.
Very strong argument. We're hooked. You are obviously a more talented lawyer than you're giving yourself credit for. Let me just say there's kind of a caveat to it being kind of fun. This is why it would only be kind of fun is, I think to be Kellyanne Conway, to be Sean Spicer hasn't gotten there, unfortunately, but Kellyanne Conway, I think, has. The only way to do it, to work for Trump as his lawyer, you got to just jump over the cliff. Forget about where you're going to land or what kind of spikes are at the bottom of the fall. You are in free fall. And is free fall kind of fun? I mean, yeah, in a way.
There you go again, Steve. With your whimsical fantasy. Now, of course, I praise you for this imagination, which can carry you almost into realms of experience which you have not entered. But I have entered those realms. I have gone off that cliff. I got one of our clients sued for $1 billion. It was not fun. It was not kind of fun. It was not a little fun. And when the check that they ultimately delivered was only $280 million, that didn't make it much better. So no, I think that plunging to your death is not kind of fun.
Well, let me just suggest that you are clinging to life, respectability, probably some sense of integrity, some sense of professional competence. That's going to be what keeps it from being all the way fun. To be Donald Trump's lawyer, you're going to have to let all that go and just start spewing whatever, just throwing up snares and fire in the path of what's coming at you as you slowly like walk away and hope that you end up in a hammock somewhere in a Caribbean island.
Well,
right?
I feel that could be cathartic.
Yeah.
I do not feel that would be successful.
Like,
and if I could be a villain and a bumbler and a boob and somehow go home at the end of the day as a big hero, that all worked, that would be okay.
Yes.
But I don't think it's all going to work. I think Donald Trump, to bring it around, Donald Trump is really bungling his presidency. And it's not going to end well for him. I mean, I'm not enough of a lawyer to know what counts we can get him on yet. But I feel like he's conducting himself incompetently in a way that would lead to ultimately failure for him and his legal team.
Who is his lawyer? Do we know?
There's some guy.
There's some guy or gal.
He better maybe. Be good. Yeah. But the problem is he won't even listen to them if they are good.
Right.
But now that's a very normal lawyer's problem and, you know, helps you feel better about losing. But
I mean, I see like the F. Lee Bailey's and the Johnny Cochran's as depicted in the O.J. People versus O.J. And it seems like they just get to this place of once playing the game.
Once again, I beg to differ, sir. You are talking about good lawyers, and I am talking about me.
Right. Okay.
And F. Lee Bailey goes into there. I mean, I don't think he's that good a lawyer, but he knows, he believes in F. Lee Bailey. I don't even believe in me.
Right.
So, and Johnny Cochran seemed to really have a game plan. I wouldn't have a game plan, and I wouldn't believe in myself. And I certainly wouldn't know if I was right. So I think that would be just a panic.
Okay, let me make a closing statement. I think that day one, yeah, you would be washed over with panic, shame, fear, horror. That would sweep your entire body, clean out all your glands and intestines and everything, and flood your adrenaline. But then the next day would just be completely free. And you would just, it would be like entering the Matrix. Like reality would have ended.
Once again, Steve, you're right. So I guess but with that experience of transcendence.
Yeah.
Does that really fair to call transcendent experience kind of fun? Haven't we now entered a realm of purity and freedom from the desire for the lowly diversion called fun?
Right.
Aren't we in a space of purity and bliss at that point that is not accurately described as kind of fun?
Yeah, I guess so. But this might be a next level, you know?
But is that kind of fun or is it bliss?
Yeah, you might be right. It may be kind of fun. Is in fact exactly where I'm going to get hooked.
It understates the transcendental release that would be possible after the catastrophic failure.
Right. Okay. Well, let me close out with
of
just
my being Trump's lawyer.
Like, we talked about free fall, and you accused me of not having had the experience of being a lawyer, which is true. But I did once go skydiving, and the experience of stepping out of the airplane is terrible. That is really scary and awful, and your body is like, no, I belong in the airplane. Then you let go, and then you just fall to the earth. And all told, I would say skydiving is exactly kind of fun. I've never done it again.
Okay, but
yeah.
So you're averaging the before and after to come up
right.
with this kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah.
And I question your methodology, sir. So you're taking a state of abject terror and adding it to one of transcendental bliss and calling it kind of fun. And I just don't know if that math adds up. I would say that the abject terror is a pretty ordinary feeling in the transcendent release seems to be an unbounded and infinite upwards feeling, so that I think that it's more, you're still on average above kind of fun.
Medina, what do you think of the debate?
Is the idea here that we're not arguing that it's not kind of fun because it's not fun at all? We're arguing that actually it's really quite fun.
We've gotten to the point that it would lead to a state of bliss. But is that state of bliss, when averaged together with the prior state of terror, accurately described as kind of fun or not? And it seems to me that it probably still a bit above. One, I don't know if they can be averaged. And two, if they are averaged, do they come out at kind of fun?
Yeah. Is extreme horror and terror plus total zen bliss?
Is being the Buddha kind of fun? Like, it seems like the upside of the release Buddhist is smile. Higher than the downside of suffering.
In my limited readings of Buddhist texts, I've never heard him described as kind of fun or as nirvana as kind of fun.
But maybe this state, this post-Trump representational state, is not... It's with Nirvana.
That's true too.
We're in Nirvana.
Yeah.
My takeaway, I think, is that there's probably a couple of guys out there, handful of lawyers for whom this would be kind of fun and who would have the kind of experience that Healy described. But for the vast majority of legal professionals out there in the United States and maybe even beyond, the experience would be a lot more like what Dan Graney described.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. Also, I don't...
I think what I honestly think is that for most lawyers, they would love it, you know, because it would be, they like attention, they like a challenge. But for me personally, or a bad lawyer in general, and I guess a lot of lawyers are bad.
Yeah.
We don't want it. We don't want to go anywhere near it. Everybody's going to see me. How bad we are.
It isn't like most semi-good lawyers, aren't they kind of obsessed with like...
So your elite lawyers would love this because they could handle it.
I think...
But us schlubs...
Once the debate's over, I'm going to say that actually even the most elite lawyers would hate it because what they like is dotting their T's and getting everything airtight and locked down, and Trump is obviously the opposite of that. He's completely sloppy and...
I think they don't mind something being hard.
Okay.
You know, and it's a hard thing, but...
Do they mind participating and possibly enabling a semi-dictator?
I think some of them would definitely mind that. I, as a lawyer, mainly tried to... to spend as much time copying documents as possible.
Yeah. Mm.
So if I were Trump's lawyer, I would probably spend a lot of time copying.
At the Xerox machine.
At the Xerox machine.
I'm on it, boss.
And I will say that when the machine is humming and you got it in a continuous run, it's kind of fun.
Nirvana. It's collating.
Is it kind of fun or is it bliss? Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining us on the Great Debates. I thought that was a super funny episode and had a great time.
Terrific.
Heels, always a pleasure.
Thank you all. Thank you for having me. It is more than kind of fun to be part of this experience.
Guys, write to us, tweet at us, comment on our Instagram. You were Great Debate 69 everywhere. And we'll see you next week on the Great Debates.
The Great Debates is produced by Mark Caracello. The theme song was composed by Christopher Knight. The debaters are Steve Healy and Dave King, and the podcast is moderated by Dan Medina.